It's a somber day for all of us here at Political Rewind, certainly, but for all of you who are listening out there. As you know, listening to NPR's continuing coverage by now, at least 58 people dead, as many as 500 wounded in the Las Vegas shootings. We'll take a few minutes to talk about that, but again, you're listening to NPR's network coverage if you've been listening on our air here across the state today, so we don't want to repeat and do a less good job here in our local operation than they're doing nationally. Let's start by telling y'all who's here with us. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, of course. You read him now on Wednesdays and Sundays in the AJC, and he oversees the Political Insider blog, or Politically Georgia.
Politically Georgia right now, yeah. Yeah, I would say good afternoon, but it's not one.
Yeah, it's a very tough day. Brian Robinson, Republican consultant, former communications director for Nathan Deal. It's Monday, so Brian, you are here with us, as you usually are on Mondays. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Lori Geary, former political reporter for WSB-TV, took my job and ran with it and elevated it to heights I never could have reached.
Tough shoes
in that
to fill,
job.
Bill
oh,
Nigut.
Give me a break. We haven't seen you for a while. I'm really glad you're back.
Good to be back.
Lori's in private business. You do communications, consulting, that sort of thing. Yeah?
Yeah, media consulting. It's been great.
Okay,
yeah.
Terrific. Our special guest today, we're really excited to have Kathy Cox, former Georgia Secretary of State, Democratic candidate for governor in 2004.
Six.
thank you. Kathy, you're now the dean.
Yeah, I thought you were going to skip that.
Dean of the Mercer Law School. Big
That's
deal.
Right. My alma mater.
Oh, it is your alma mater.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Terrific. One of the reasons said you'd come in today, and we're going to talk about this in a couple of minutes, is you're going to be presiding over not a debate.
Not a forum,
but a
conversation tonight.
Between the two Stacey's, Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans, the two announced Democratic candidates for governor. We'll get to that in just a minute. And it'll also talk about your experiences as a woman running for governor of Georgia. We'll see if there are things that made that a unique situation for you. But let's start just update you on the Georgia response to what's gone on out in Las Vegas. Of course, most of our elected officials have been making statements, tweeting about it. Most of them are what you would expect. They're standard expressions of sympathy, meaningful, but standard expressions of sympathy. Worth noting is Governor Deal, who said, of course, there's no logical way to explain what happened. We'll never understand it. He calls it the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. But he then goes on and points out the legislation that he was behind to raise the salaries of state law enforcement officers and require that they have additional training. He said that's why it's important we did what we did to increase the salaries to keep the best and to attract the best. Brian, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. Of course, our law enforcement have been very low paid for a very long time. And I know that I think it was 20%. Is that what it was? Was it?
It was a 20% raise. Yeah.
20% raise. Yeah. Which you don't get many of those in state government work. So
it came with required extra training. And it's caused some controversy because other agencies have had to match that.
It has, and that's going to be an issue actually in the governor's race about how do we help counties and cities raise those salaries, because they're going to lose people to trooper school, because sometimes the differential can be $15,000. Some of these counties starting salaries for officers is about $28,000, and so if you can do $15,000 to $20,000 better as a trooper, you're going to do that.
But I think it's the one area of government that taxpayers don't have a problem paying for. I mean, it's what we expect the government to do, is to serve and protect us. So I don't think that you get a lot of backlash from taxpayers when you announce an increase in pay for law enforcement.
The other statement worth mentioning. And, you know, Jim, at a certain point you say, are we picking on him individually? And the answer is, no, he just keeps giving us reason to talk about him.
He is raising his hand and volunteering for attention.
State Senator Michael Williams, who, of course, is a Republican candidate for governor, tweeted his question as to whether any NFL players would, quote, take a knee to law enforcement during Monday night's NFL game will remember you. He added, and he's been pounded on social media throughout the day today.
Well, if one side can pound the other for mentioning the taboo topics of gun restrictions, well, then I guess it's fair play.
You know, and that brings up a point. This is going to, of course, lead to renewed conversation about whether we need gun laws that will restrict the use of guns. Kathy, guys, those conversations after every one of these terrible, terrible events have gone absolutely nowhere.
But I don't think that means the conversation won't happen or shouldn't happen, along with additional conversations about mental health and how we treat the mentally ill in this country or not. Resources have dwindled dramatically across the country. And we've got to address those issues.
Yeah, we don't know anything about the shooter, really. We know he's fairly local to Las Vegas.
Yeah,
we know his name.
And he's a regular
gambler
in the casinos.
But we know nothing about his medical history at this point. All that remains to be seen.
And if I can just say on
sure.
Michael Williams' social media, you know, it's great that we all have a platform to express what we're thinking. The bad news is that social media is a race to the bottom, because there's a reason why you, Bill, chose his tweet to mention on air, even though it's, you know, doesn't reflect well on him. He's being talked about because it's outrageous, because it is untimely, because it's not what you say in the immediate aftermath of an attack like this. But it provides these perverse incentives to be the meanest, to be the nastiest, to be the most inappropriate, because it does get attention. And the bar is so low that you've got to go to ever further extremes to keep getting noticed.
Well, speaking of mean and nasty tweets, our door is open at Politics GPB. You may have nice things to say, you may have not so nice things to say, but we always like hearing from you. So tweet us at Politics GPB. Lori, going back for a moment to this notion of guns, one of the things that I would imagine is going to get some real attention here is Representative Jeff Duncan of South Carolina is the guy who early this year sponsored a bill that would ease restrictions on silencers. That's been hotly debated already on the Hill. It's still sitting up there. And I would guess, when you look at the video that most people by now have probably seen of the concert, and you hear the gunfire, you can tell people are reacting. At first, they don't know what it is. Then it becomes clear it's gunfire. Hearing that semi-automatic weapon.
No, that was full automatic.
Okay. Okay.
That was or a full automatic or
a version of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. If that had been a silencer, who knows what might have happened.
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the folks in the crowd you heard say, we thought it was fireworks, we thought it was part of the show, and then kind of reality sets in and reality hits. But I just feel like every time one of these incidents happen, it's we go back to gun control, we debate, and then nothing happens.
Yep.
Also, I think one of the areas where both sides can agree, and obviously this guy was some sort of mentally ill to be able to do this, is that, you know, keeping guns out of the hands of the mentally ill. Both sides agree, but the question is, how do you do it in this age of HIPAA laws and, you know, the age of, you know, you can't disclose anything and, boy, you can check the box on yes or no. You check the box on whether or not you have been diagnosed with mental illness in order to get a gun. So the debate's going to rage on about this, but, you know, with Republicans and nothing will change.
There is that, and the shooting to me, as soon as I heard about it this morning, it just reminded me, it took me back to 1966 and the University of Texas in Austin, where we had another shooter up on a bell tower. Except this one is different because the technology is improved, if you will. I'll put that in quotes. And of course, we do have a new law in Georgia that allows guns on campus. Now we've got a lawsuit now that has been filed against that that challenges it, not on the merits, but on the authority of the legislature to do so.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the Texas Bell Tower shootings because my recollection is that was a rifle. It may have been a single action rifle. I don't really know, but. Mm-hmm.
I think also the conversation changes also with in terms of security, because I was watching one of the news stations this morning after my kids went to school because I couldn't believe it was another day where I couldn't turn on the TV. And they were talking about New York Times Square and the fact that, you know, New York City police have to be on top of buildings, yeah. You know, over areas like that in New York City. And I think it's a question, and that's a topic that all of law enforcement across the country now will be looking at. We had mentioned the Atlanta Braves or the SunTrust Braves, the SunTrust Park now.
Yeah, the new park.
Those are issues where law enforcement is going to have to take a second look at.
All right. Well, we'll all keep track of this, obviously, as awful details become more and more clear. And at 3 o'clock, NPR is going to pick up their coverage, their live continuous coverage of this. So let's turn to what's going on in this state politically. Kathy Cox, you're in town to oversee, as we said, to moderate this conversation between Stacey and Stacey, Abrams and Evans. Just set it up for us a little bit. What's the format of it? How's it going to look? Tell us about what we got to look forward to this evening.
Well, it'll happen tonight at the Carter Center, sponsored by Georgia's Win List, which is a PAC to elect Democratic women in Georgia. So they are not taking a position between the two Stacys, and so they're bringing both of them to the table tonight, Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams, to have a conversation that I'm going to moderate. We hope it will be very substantive. We'll ask them a lot of questions across the spectrum of timely, topical issues in Georgia, so that the audience hopefully will get a really good feel for where both of these women are and how they hope to lead Georgia forward.
You want to give us any of your questions in advance?
I don't think so.
I'm supposing we can suppose that both candidates will be on their best behavior.
Mm-hmm.
In this kind of audience. Things were a little bit rough this summer, especially when Stacey Evans went before the Netroots meeting in downtown Atlanta and was essentially booed off the stage.
That was a bonkers convention that just did so much damage. Let me tell you, if the media weren't full of liberals, they would have covered it for what a clown show that convention was. Because I'm going to tell you, if it were my side and we were having all of this crazy stuff, I mean, they would be outside talking about how racist and bigoted and crazy these people are. It doesn't happen on Netflix.
But aside from Brian, Kathy, I mean, there is a legitimate question about how Democrats should approach their paths to the nomination now. Of course, you know, you've got Stacey Abrams, who's leaning very heavily on African American women and intensifying that vote. And of course, you've got Stacey Evans, who is born in Ringgold, Georgia, and had a rather blue collar upbringing. And there are people who think that gives her access to voters that the Democrats have been losing. So how do you address that? How do you draw that out?
Well, certainly the candidates with their responses will bring responses to the table that I think will try to attract their base voters. But I think it will be a really interesting primary process and certainly primary election next spring to see how that plays out in a Democratic electorate that has become more and more minority-based. Stacey Evans is hoping to attract more white voters back into the Democratic primary, but that has not been the way the demographics have been trending. So it's going to be a really interesting demographic shakeout.
It really is, Laurie. You know, there's going to be plenty of really interesting, important races on ballots around the country in 2018. But, you know, I think it's interesting that the 6th District special election, the Ossoff-Handel election, got so much attention nationwide. This, because it could be a laboratory for how the Democratic Party rethinks its base, should be something that Democrats around the country will pay attention to as they look toward 2020.
Well, you know, in the governor's race, I think this one is more interesting than the Republican race because everybody believes that Casey Cagle, at least at this point in time, is the Republican frontrunner, especially on fundraising, Brian. But I also think it's interesting because you have two Democratic women who are great candidates. Both of them are really great, formidable opponents. And it'll be interesting to see how they differentiate themselves and how they attract and what is that Democratic message in a state like Georgia, which is, you know, trending Republican. But also we'll have to see how the whole Trump issue plays out here in Georgia. You know, Metro Atlanta versus rural Georgia will be interesting to watch.
Yeah,
it is a race that's getting a lot of national attention for the obvious reason that no state in the country has ever elected an African-American female as governor.
Right.
And Stacey Abrams is getting a lot of national attention for that reason in and of itself. But the fact that the Democratic Party is putting up two women alone as the two principal candidates is certainly very exciting to a lot of people like me.
Yeah, I want to talk about
that. It's interesting that in the race, probably you guys have the top four, that you know, that Stacey's on one side and you have Brian Kemp and Casey Cagle on the other. All four grew up poor or relatively poor. You know, Casey talks a lot in his stump speech about growing up in a trailer and his mom, seeing his mom on her knees praying that they have money for the next meal and that they can make the rent that month. Stacey Evans, of course, has, you know, lived in 18 houses or 12 houses, whatever it was, but, you know, as a child moving place to place. Stacey Abrams, great story, grew up mm-hmm. in a large family in Mississippi and ended up going to Yale Law School.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a remarkable story of Horacio Alger.
Horacina Alger.
Hey, Brian, so Jim Galloway says, and I'm not sure if you said this tongue-in-cheek or not, we'll find out in a sec, we expect the candidates to be on their best behavior in front of this crowd tonight. As a Republican, as a consultant, regardless of party, would you advise them to make this this is a big opportunity. By the way, Ben tweets to us, will tonight's debate be available to watch on TV or online? The Georgia win list was not able to make that happen. Olivia Rheingold, our associate producer, is going to be there. She's going to be recording it for radio, and we will have as much as we can of it on – we'll have sound bites on Wednesday's show. But would you advise them to early on in a campaign introduce themselves as positively as possible, tonight try to define who they are before their opponent defines them? Or is it already time, given the rough summer that Galloway pointed out, for them to start looking at going after one another? What would you advise?
I have a firm theory on this. I'm glad you asked. I believe that in a multi-candidate field, where if two people are going at each other, you can go to a third or fourth person, that going negative is a bad idea. Because when you attack, you may drive up the negatives of your opponent, but you also drive up your own. But if it's mano a mano or womano a womama,
as he's trying, Jim, he's trying.
Maybe. Your incentive is to take them down. Now, if I'm Stacey Abrams, I'm probably going to be a little soft. And I think the dynamics are different here because Abrams has a distinct advantage because this is a majority African-American primary electorate, and she's the African-American in the race. There's an inherent advantage there. Stacey Evans has to be careful because she can't look like she's beating up on an African-American woman in a majority African-American primary. So both of them have some different calculations here. I think in other circumstances, I would say go for the jugular, take them down.
Of course he would. Of course he would. We know Brian Robinson, Jim.
But it's trickier here.
Jim.
Kathy, let's take you back to 2006. As you're a female candidate for governor, what did you face? What were
Go ahead.
What were these two women facing that male candidates don't have
and,
to face?
And Kathy, that is a great question, but it'll have to wait until we come back from a brief break because it's time to do that. They're yelling at me in the control room. We're going to take a break right now and get back to that really good question in just a minute.
GPB News has reporters across the state. We are uniquely positioned to cover big stories like Hurricane Irma.
Southwest Georgia was hit by two tornadoes back in January that killed 19 people. While recovery from those storms continues in Albany, the city now finds itself in the track of Hurricane Irma.
Amber and Travis Combs had hundreds of reasons to stay. They own an exotic pet store in Guyton.
Heavy rains and high winds began to build before dawn in Augusta.
Listen to GPB News. We cover the state of Georgia and we stand with the facts.
Jim Galloway, Lori Geary, Brian Robinson, and Kathy Cox, our special guest today. Kathy, Galloway asked you a great question. What was it like? What were the unique circumstances of being a female candidate for governor in your race?
Well, I'd like to say I hope that the political winds have changed a lot over the last 10 years. I certainly saw the change from 1998 when I first ran for Secretary of State, when every week somebody questioned whether a woman could do the job. And I had to remind them that it didn't involve heavy lifting. But in 2006, I rarely heard that, but maybe it had just gone underground because I certainly could sense that there were people who still weren't certain about it. I hope now we're beyond that, but I wouldn't be so sure. Regrettably, women still have to deal with the look thing, people questioning whether her hair, her weight, her makeup, and all of the superficial things are just right. And sadly, I think, and women are just as bad about this as men, women are held to this standard of purity and perfection that male candidates can be thrice married, have all kind of ethical issues and challenges, and people just sort of overlook it.
Did you have to be cautious in how you comported yourself as a woman candidate?
Always.
What does that mean, though?
Well, because in the South, I think for women who are strong and assertive, that turns quickly into the B-I-T-C-H word.
This is public radio. You can say that.
No, it's all right. This is public radio. People can spell.
They can spell. That's right.
Go ahead.
And that's a delicate dance for women in politics, because if you're not strong enough, then the obvious counter to that is that you're not strong enough to hold the office. That's never an issue for men.
Yeah. Lori, what are the parallels here with TV?
I was wondering the same thing.
It's true. I think when you talk about even the debate stage and, you know, who gets a podium, who doesn't get a podium, makeup, hair. I mean, I think Karen Handel went through this just in the last round where, you know, you had to be careful on what she wore, how she talked, the face she made on a two screen, you know, on the double screen where she was in a debate with John Ossoff. But I also think that you think we've come so far and then you cover a race like Donald Trump's. When he goes after Carly Fiorina and her looks, and perhaps we haven't, you know. But you're right, because I think the female candidates can come across as B-I-T-C-H-Y if they are strong, and they really are held to a different standard, even covering them.
Well, you know? I thought Jim asked you another – I thought there was another aspect to this question which is really interesting, which is what you as a female reporter in terms of comportment – you know, as a male reporter, there were times I could be very aggressive in the way I questioned elected officials. Now, there were times when people would get pretty irritated, upset with me for that. But I wonder if there's a different standard for you as a woman reporter, or is the public just always going to be skeptical that you're attacking their person, not the other guy?
You know, I can honestly say this as a female reporter. I never felt that.
Okay.
The things that I did feel were the good old boys down at the state capitol. I mean, I'm sure, Kathy, the things that you heard down at the state capitol that somebody wouldn't repeat to their mom, but they would repeat to me, you know, as a female reporter. It's just, you know, but I never felt, because I was a female reporter, that people didn't take me seriously, you know, because I think if you just do your job, I mean, I don't know kind of
the obvious
on that.
Is the Megyn Kelly situation in the debates. You know, she was certainly held to a different standard and attacked for things that no one would have even commented on as a male reporter.
Let me ask you, is there a difference between male and female candidates when it comes to fundraising? I mean, is it harder for female candidates to generate the kind of financial commitments?
Well, I personally don't think so, and I think I tried to put that to rest, because in the governor's race in 2006, I raised as much as my wealthy opponent at a time.
This is Lieutenant Governor Mark Taylor.
Right, and that was at a time when people questioned whether women could raise money. I think that women are not naturally in the arena where they have a lot of experience at it as much as men, and so they're newer to the game, but I think donors are certainly as supportive.
Is it a matter of networking? The networks aren't the infrastructure?
The infrastructure and networks are not as readily available to women, and they have to get out and be assertive and raise it and persuade people that they're a viable candidate.
All right.
You look at the results from July, and both of the Stacys are significantly behind in fundraising to Cagle and Kemp. Now, that could be more of the Georgia brand of Republican versus Democratic politics right now, but there's a significant difference right now.
All right. We wish you well in this debate tonight. I'm sorry, conversation. Do us a favor, though. Let them shake things up a little, would you? You know, we want to see them get a little feisty with
each other. Well, it's a good opportunity to distinguish between each other. And there may be a chance for live streaming. So the Georgia Win List Facebook page would be the place to look if they are able to live stream.
We'll watch for it. Melita Easters last week on this show said that they were having some problems with it. But you know what? Go to the Georgia Win List Facebook page tonight and see if they have been able to work it out.
I would like to suggest some questions for her. We can do that later if you want for tonight. I have some ideas that I think need to be fleshed out.
Okay. Brian Robinson. It finally hit the news this week, Jim. He is working for Casey Cagle.
He has been revealed as a Republican operative
in a position where we cannot talk to him much about gubernatorial candidates. So.
And far less let him suggest questions.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn our attention to the Tom Price story. Friday on this show, Jim, we said we signed off at 4 p.m. and before we got off the air, we said. Some of us said it doesn't feel like there's much life left, especially after Trump said he's a fine man. I'll be making a decision.
Yeah, he said that. He said that before we went away at four, and Tom Price apparently got the message and had his resignation handed in by 4:45.
You wrote a really, really terrific piece about what happened, and the lead to the piece is Tom Price was never a politician with a natural talent for building alliances, and in the end, that may have cost him. We sort of hinted at this, but it's always uncomfortable to talk about, you know, whether a guy like a Tom Price is well-liked or not, but that really did play a role in all this.
Yeah, it truly did, and I think it might be fair to call him, at times, the most unloved man in Congress. He was an incredibly hard worker. You could not outwork Tom Price. He was bright. He is bright. He still is bright. But he would, if there was a gap in his personality, he lacks social intelligence, I think, is a good way to phrase it.
I think that's spot on, Jim, because Brian and I were talking about this earlier. When you interview elected officials and candidates over and over again, you get to know them. I mean, Kathy, anytime we interviewed, you kind of get to know a little bit about their personal life, their kids, their wife, their spouse. And you never felt that with Tom Price. In the many years that I'd interviewed him, you never got kind of a sense of a personality. He's almost socially awkward in a way. And that hurts you in politics and hurts you in forming support groups and supporters, really.
It means that you may have been hired because of your connections in Congress as Secretary of Health and Human Services, but it turns out you might not have those relationships to drive a vote, either in the House or the Senate.
Yeah, and that seemed, Brian, to be one of the issues. Aside from the travel, Tom Price, to some extent, was sold by Newt Gingrich, among others, as the physician who could whip the vote for a repeal and replace bill. That's how they sold him to Donald Trump. And it turned out that Price's lack of real relationships on the Hill, particularly in the Senate, but even in the House, didn't have the kind of power to move people the way that perhaps the president thought he would have to. Not to mention the fact he seemed to be absent for a lot of the work going on to try to repeal and replace.
Yeah, you know, I love Jim's piece, by the way. I had several friends writing me because I actually was connected to some of the stuff he was writing about. You know, in 2010, I was with Governor, then Congressman Deal, when Congressman Price pulled his endorsement from Deal and switched it over to Handel.
He had endorsed your former boss, Nathan Deal. And then when the story that perhaps there was going to be some scandal that was going to engulf a deal, he switched over to...
Right. And somebody in the Deal campaign turned out an interesting statement from the had the Deal's name on it, basically said that having been brought up in Georgia, I was always taught that people kept their words. Which is
oddly familiar to me when I read that.
Which is another way of saying he ain't from around here.
He ain't from around here, and he's not. But the
other part of that story was that also that same spring, Johnny Isaacson had been hospitalized twice with a staph infection.
Yeah.
And there was talk going around that what Price was actually doing was making a bet that Karen Handel would win the governorship, and she did come close.
Yeah.
And that if Isaacson didn't fill out his term, Tom Price would be in line for that seat.
Yes, and so the Isaacson people had hard feelings too. So you have two of the most important political networks in the state that have got hard feelings. Now, they have been patched up, I will say. I don't think there's ill will at this juncture. But we redistricted in 2011 when the feelings were still pretty raw. And this ended up having significant impact on Georgia this year because Tom Price had no seat at the table when we were drawing seats for Congress in 2011. And so a lot of Democrats got put into his district and Republicans were scattered around to other members of Congress. And the Prices were like, this district's going to be very Democratic by the end of the decade. And sure enough... Mm-hmm. We get John Ossoff with 48% of the vote. And it's all because of a decision he made in 2011.
So this is all really fascinating political talk. But Lori, a couple of things that really are going to have an impact here. One of them for sure, the state of Georgia, Republican officials in Georgia felt that with Price at HHS, mm-hmm. He might be able to help this state in many ways, including the possibility of easing the way for waivers that would have allowed the state, if the conversation had gone forward, to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. Whatever favor Georgia might have had is now out the window.
Well, and it was a sense of pride for Georgia Republicans, too, to have the HHS secretary from Georgia. And as Georgia kind of debates this issue of Medicaid expansion, I mean, there was Tom Price at the helm being able to guide and kind of tell folks where they were headed. But also, it always goes back to my theory that I think every Washington official up there, cabinet member, congressman, senator, should have a common sense consultant that, you know what, you have been railing on the Democrats for using private airfare, private jets, and then you turn around and do the very same thing? Like, I never heard from Tom Price why he did it. You know, there were, you know, you wanted to hear him say, well, it was because of security reasons, it was because I had to get from here to here to here, but you never heard the reason why.
Yeah, and his apology was half-hearted at best, even in the letter of resignation.
He regretted the discomfiture that this had created.
So, Kathy Cox, let me bring you into this conversation in a different way, if I may. The president has an opportunity here, perhaps. Price was a hardliner, obviously, on the Affordable Care Act, and was the one Republican on the Hill who was able to, in fact, craft a bill that seemed to be a viable replacement. It, of course, wasn't ever going to get signed by President Obama. But in his capacity as HHS secretary, he was already beginning to scale back on ACA in ways that were detrimental to the program. So here's the question. President Trump can find someone who is in that vein who will continue that effort, or this is an opportunity for the president perhaps to recognize that the repeal and replace has failed over and over. Maybe it's time to bring someone in who has a more open-minded approach to what needs to be done to fix the system.
Well, you're asking me if he's going to make a logical decision is a stretch, you know. Logically, if you really wanted to get some health care legislation passed, in light of his Chuck and Nancy, friendship, he might pass somebody that could, nominate someone who actually could bring some people together on the Hill, particularly some Democrats, and put together a bill that could draw from both sides of the aisle. I frankly do not expect that will happen.
But I will tell you that when he does nominate somebody, I think we are going to have a very specific debate over what comes next. And that'll be a crucial part of any interview between the nominee and the senators.
Brian, are you convinced, because you have said as much before, are you convinced that repeal and replace, that Republicans have not, in fact, had enough with repeal and replace and perhaps are now looking for other ways to approach this thing, or are they just going to keep it up?
You know, I always said, repair and revise would have been a better way to move forward and call it repeal and replace, to just make some change that's significant enough that it passes muster. The fact is they're not going to have much choice, because the thing is, there's been a lot of rhetoric around this, but it's not just rhetoric. The system is imploding. You know, just last week, our insurance commissioner here in Georgia approved massive premium increases for the plans that are on the Georgia Exchange. That's not sustainable. This is supposed to be able to meet these working-class Georgians.
Yeah, but Lori, Brian, Brian, because one of the reasons insurance companies are saying over and over again, of course, they were raising rates in a way that was uncomfortable. No question about that. But insurance companies have been saying, we are so uncertain what's going to happen next in Washington with health care that we just don't know where we're headed. So it is as much a responsibility of the Trump administration as it is of what Obamacare did.
And you've already got Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray of Washington, Democrat and Republican, working together to make sure that those federal subsidies that were driving those health care, those massive increases that Ralph Hudgens signed on to make sure that they're going to stay in place, and so those massive increases won't occur. Yep. Maybe they'll be 25% or 30%, but not 50%.
So let's see what happens with them. Meanwhile, as we go to break, Lori, we've already passed a very important deadline, and the consequences of Congress not acting on health care are already being felt. The CHIP program, the program that gives health care, inoculations, standard checkups, all the routine things that the rest of us take for granted our children.
Known as Peach Care here.
It's Peach Care in this state. It's the funding has expired. It was October 1st. Congress did not act. There's some money left, but it's not going to last long unless something happens. And that's just one of the programs.
And that's got to be fixed. I mean, you know that the folks in Washington are not going to let that go, because that would be political suicide. Mm-hmm. So,
and here's why. It's bipartisan, because the CHIP program isn't Medicaid. A lot of Republican voters have their kids on Peach Care or in CHIP nationally. So it's not just, Democrats won't vote for us anyway. These are our voters.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we got a few other really interesting items, I think, to talk about. One of them with Kathy Cox here. Let's talk about voting machines. You were very involved in voting machines in your tenure as Secretary of State. And then let's talk about a big case that the Supreme Court is going to handle tomorrow on the very thing Brian Robinson was talking about, gerrymandering. We'll be right back.
A gunman fires out of a hotel window, killing dozens and wounding hundreds of people attending a country music festival in Las Vegas.
You have to establish what his motivation is, and there's motivating factors associated with terrorism.
I'm Robert Siegel. All Things Considered will follow the latest on the most deadly mass shooting in modern U.S. history. That's later today from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 7 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Kathy Cox, while you were Secretary of State, you took a very big, big action. You decided it was time that Georgia go to electronic voting machines. It was a big deal at the time you made that decision.
Well, there was a little thing called the 2000 presidential election that gave me a little fire.
That's right, the butterfly ballot in Florida, which changed everything.
And we found that Georgia had, in fact, lost 94,000 votes of its own after that election. So we had to make changes. We had the whole array of different voting equipment. So we became the first in the nation to go to a uniform electronic form of voting. And Caltech and MIT did a study and found that we went from one of the second worst voting accuracy rates to the second best in the nation.
Yeah, one of the things I remember, Jim, looking back on that, was the Secretary of State's office did a really good job rolling this out because it was controversial. There were many people who thought it was going to be it was an effort by Democrats to control votes in there. But I thought the Secretary of State's office dealing with media, helping us walk through the system, understand it so we could explain it to our readers, our viewers. They did that very well.
They did. And I don't think a whole lot of people remember is that voting methods changed from county to county. There was no uniformity, and quite frankly, a lot of returns were taken home at night and put under a bedstead. You know, it wasn't that secure. Paper ballots or no paper ballots. I think right now, I mean, that was an attempt to solve that problem. And now we've got new problems, of course, which all relate to the internet and hacking, and I know you're very defensive about the inability of hackers to go into these machines that we've got, but they can go into the ancillary systems that are associated with voting these days.
Well, by ancillary, I think you're referring to the voter registration system that is found in polling places. And most of that was developed after I left the Secretary of State's office. So I think there is some opportunity there that extra security is in place. But none of the voting machines are now or have ever been connected to the internet.
As you look at it now, all these years later, 15 plus years later, is it time for Georgia to go to new machines? And should those new machines include a paper trail?
Yes, it's probably time. But you have to consider these are not machines that are used on a daily basis. So they're not as worn out as would be your own laptop if it were used every day for the last 15 plus years. Every machine continues to be tested before every single election. So there's a whole battery of security protocols in place to make sure that every machine is still working accurately. But there was no paper trail available in 2002 when we put these in place. That could certainly give voters some level of confidence, but you don't want to go back to a situation where you're creating a paper ballot that can be manipulated.
Right. Now, I don't know if you've kept up with the technology. Do systems exist that can do that?
I have not seen them myself. I've heard that some companies are trying to put out something that does have a rolling tape of paper that could be contained, not handed to a voter.
Okay, well, it's an issue that's not going to go away, and we're going to have to keep track of it. So thanks for sharing your... It was interesting when you came in, I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, this is the Secretary of State who put the machines into play here in Georgia. Lori Geary, the Supreme Court does hear a huge political case tomorrow. I've said in my note to all of you, in some ways, it's another Citizens United. It has that potential to be a huge impact on gerrymandering, on redistricting. The case is Gill versus Whitford. It's a Wisconsin case. It challenges whether or not legislatures can create districts along partisan lines.
And that really, when you think about every state in this country, this is how districts are drawn, and this is why critics say there's got to be a better way, there's got to be a better system, because it's not likely that the legislatures, the governors are going to flip because of all of this gerrymandering. This does have far-reaching implications. We've seen other lawsuits filed in places like Texas, but this really could have an impact here on Georgia.
It's interesting. John Barrow has an op-ed in today's Washington Post.
Saw that.
He is the former congressman who was gerrymandered out of Athens and then out of Augusta and into Savannah until they finally got him in 2014, and he's now running for Secretary of State, Kathy Cox's old job. And he's got his piece in the Post today suggests that maybe the court should create a new standard in bipartisan competition, that let that be the highest standard. create all your districts so that they are as competitive as possible?
Well, that'll be interesting to see, because we're waiting to see whether the court really believes it has a role in interfering in what in the past they've said is a political process. Brian, let's just explain what happens here, and we can do it with our own state. Excuse me. Governor Roy Barnes, Democratic Governor Roy Barnes, with his chief of staff, Bobby Kahn, who we've talked about on the show before, worked together really as a team with those very sophisticated now computers that can draw, can change a map in a heartbeat. They gerrymandered the state to the advantage of Democrats all over the place. We get a flip. Republicans take control here, as they did in many states around the country, and they drew lines that favored Republicans, and that's where we stand right now. Republicans dominant in legislatures, having control in Congress because of the way district lines are drawn. So this case could change everything. Oh, and we should also point out, the courts have already ruled you can't gerrymander on the basis of race, but can you do it on the basis of political identity?
Well, you can.
Which in Georgia is one and the same.
Which is one of the same here, and that's how we do it. We can say, well, we're connecting pockets of Democrats, when really what we're doing are connecting pockets of African-American neighborhoods. I want to say in Republicans' defense that I encourage anyone who's not familiar with that history to look at the maps passed by the Democrats in 2001 and compare them to the subsequent Republican maps. And just use the eye test. Does this look outrageous to you? And the Democrat maps look outrageous. Their lines would sometimes go through lakes to connect neighborhoods so that they didn't have to take in any Republican voters that might be in the middle.
That was Senate District 56 up in North Georgia.
There is no question they were very bizarre.
It was some bizarre stuff. And, of course, we had a African-American majority district that went from DeKalb County to Augusta to Savannah. I mean, it was absolutely outrageous. And, of course, on the state house level, they had multi-member districts, some with four members, some with three members, some with two members, some with one. And it was crazy. And nothing that Republicans have done since. The Republicans have drawn the map to their advantage, no doubt about it. But they've been able to do it in a way that looks much better and does keep together communities of interest better than the Democrats did, because there were more Republicans when they were drawn.
Well, Lori, there is the answer. Well, the Republican maps look nicer.
They're still
partisan.
There are equal party offenders at this process, I'll have to tell you here.
But I'm glad we're talking about this, because this is the most difficult story to tell on television, to make it interesting. But voters really need to care about it.
I would add that this is a wonderful newspaper story.
It is.
But this case could have dramatic impact on what happens in Georgia in 2021.
Tell us how.
Not only because the next governor will have a lot to do with the next reapportionment of all the House, Senate, and congressional districts, but depending on what the Supreme Court does here, if they really take a step to say that you cannot go into this extreme partisan type of gerrymandering, it will be a new world for how maps are drawn.
Does it open the way for these nonpartisan or bipartisan line drawing commissions?
I would be surprised if they tell you how it has to be done, but they could set standards to say how much partisanship can be used in the map drawing.
Absolutely. It would be a gross violation of federalism for the Supreme Court to tell states how they had to do it, and that should not happen. This is an inherently political process, and it will be an inherently political process. But let me say, part of Georgia's history and why our lines have played out the way they have over the last 50 years is because formerly the Voting Rights Act, which no longer is in place here as far as like giving Washington review of our lines like they used to, forced the state to seek out ways to get minority. To have minority representation, because for so long we had none, and so we had to draw African American majority districts so that they could have a quote unquote candidate.
And what it did was it encouraged the bargaining, at least in Georgia, especially in the 1990s, between rising Republicans and African American Democrats to create, and African-American Democrats were looking for, they were looking for a congressional seat here, and they were looking for, they were looking for more Senate, state Senate seats there. And what you did was you had this bargain that was struck between Republicans and African-American Democrats, and right now, yeah. I think black Democrats will tell you that that was probably a mistake.
Sam Burnham, who is a really attentive listener to the show, which we appreciate, says there wasn't all this complaining about gerrymandering when the Democrats were doing it. With all due respect, Sam Burnham obviously wasn't covering the legislature then, because, boy, the Republicans were howling about it.
It's what brought Sonny Perdue into the governor's race.
That's exactly right. As much as we talk about the flag being responsible for Roy Barnes going down, as much as we talk about teachers being angry at him, there was a lot of public response, Kathy Cox, to the way in which the legislature was redistricted and congressional seats as well.
There really was, and just like Brian said, because all of a sudden the natural geographic boundaries of lines went out the window, and one neighbor found out that their neighbor across the street was in a different district. Across the state, that became much more of the norm, and generally people didn't like it.
All right, we are out of time for today's show. Mr. Galloway, it's always great to have you on Mondays, and I'll see you again on a Friday show. Buddy Darden will be back with us on Friday.
Uncle
By
Buddy.
Popular demand, people cannot get enough of having Buddy on the show. He'll be with us Friday. Brian Robinson, thank you for being here today. Lori Geary, you
thank
too.
You.
Come back more often, would you please?
Sure. Thank
Kathy
you.
Cox, I hope tonight is really an informative, instructive evening, and I know if anybody can moderate a conversation to get the best out of these two, it'll be you. Thanks for joining
thank
us.
You. Great to see you
today.
All.
Yeah. We're going to pick up in a minute with NPR's ongoing coverage, live coverage of the tragic shootings in Las Vegas. They'll be coming up when we're off the air. In the meantime, my thanks to Jenny Ament, to Olivia Rheingold, and I want to welcome our new Political Rewind producer, Tom Faust, joins us today. Longtime veteran of CNN, of some local TV news, the Weather Channel. Tom, it's wonderful to have you on board. We're glad you're here. We'll be back, of course, on Wednesday at 2, and then Thursday at 2 on Two-Way Street. We'll talk more about it on Wednesday. But Thursday at 2, we're doing a show about one of the strangest incidents of the Civil War. The town of Townline, New York, the only a jurisdiction north of the Mason-Dixon line, which seceded from the Union for reasons no one can seem to remember happened, but it was also one of the final stops on the Underground Railroad that helped slaves escape to Canada. And we're going to be talking to Darren Wong, who grew up in Townline and has now written a novel based on those peculiarities about his hometown. That's on Two-Way Street on Thursday. In the meantime, see you here on Wednesday at 2 for another Political Rewind.